This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson, visiting Michigan Radio in Ann Arbor. Senator Bernie Sanders was not necessarily a national household name at the beginning of the 2016 election, but his message and support that grew after the winning the New Hampshire primary made what was once thought to be a political coronation a real competition. Well, it's 3 years later, and Bernie Sanders is not an underdog anymore. According to the latest Monmouth poll, the Vermont senator is second in a crowded field of Democratic candidates. Bernie Sanders joins us now from the U.S. Capitol. Senator Sanders, welcome back to 1A.
Great to be with you, Joshua.
Senator Sanders, let me start with the same question that we're starting with for all of the Democratic candidates. Why should the American people elect you president?
Because I have a track record which indicates that for many years I have been a champion of the needs of working families, that I've had the guts to take on the wealthiest people in this country and the most powerful institutions in order to create a nation and a government and an economy that works for all of us and not just the 1%. Now, as you mentioned a moment ago, obviously I ran for president in 2016, and I think what's important to state is that many of the ideas that I fought for 4 years ago, which at that time seemed radical and extreme, well, you know what? They ended up making sense to ordinary Americans. And today, they are part of the political conversation and in some cases are being implemented into law. So I think we have to recognize that right now we have two major crises facing this country. We need to defeat the most dangerous president in the history of America, a man who is a pathological liar, a racist, and a sexist, and a homophobe, and a xenophobe, and a religious bigot. But secondly, we need an agenda that speaks to the needs of the middle class and working families, something that is going to excite people, get people involved in the political process, so we can create an unprecedented grassroots movement, large voter turnout, so that we can transform this country in very fundamental ways.
We got lots of great policy questions about that, and I'm going to dive into that in just 1 second. But with regards to your run, I hear you in terms of some of the things that you espoused on the campaign trail are now no longer specifically just your ideas. More people are talking about them. Your 2016 run did affect the Democratic Party. It also led to the party changing the role of superdelegates in some ways. What was the biggest thing that you learned in that election and since then that will help you win the presidency this time?
I learned that Washington, D.C. and the Congress are way, way, way out of touch with where the American people are. It's literally, Joshua, almost like a parallel universe. What Washington is about, and under Republican leadership especially, are tax breaks for billionaires, ignoring the enormous crisis that climate change poses to our country and the world, no discussion about income and wealth inequality, no discussion about health care except how you can throw 32 million people off of the health care they have. Bottom line is that we have a political system that is corrupt, that is very, very significantly controlled by a small number of very wealthy campaign contributors who are able to exert their influence over the legislative process while the needs of ordinary Americans are ignored. It's really an unbelievable situation where you leave Washington and you go out into the real world, and I'll be in South Carolina or in North Carolina in the next few days and in Georgia and Alabama. You listen to what people are talking about. They can't live on starvation wages. They turn on their water faucet and the water that's coming out is polluted. They don't have any health care, or they can't afford the high deductibles or co-payments, or they can't afford prescription drugs, or they're terribly worried about the criminal justice system, which is largely racist, or the right of a woman to control her own body. And you sit here, and it's another world entirely. So maybe the profound separation of the reality impacting the American people and what goes on in here, that is something you have to see to believe.
Let's dive into some questions from our audience. Glad you brought up medicine because we are healthcare because we got a number of questions about Medicare for All. Let me read two of them. Ron wrote on our Facebook page, do you seriously believe that you can dismantle the entire medical insurance infrastructure in the United States and replace it with Medicare for All? I'd love to see that, but I'm pretty certain it will never, ever actually happen. And Matthew tweeted, how do you plan to pay for Medicare for All? What's the expected tax increase for the everyday American to implement something like this?
Good.
Senator?
Good questions. Let me start with Ron's question. And Ron says, how can we do this? And I think the implication of Ron's question is, look, we're going to have to take on the pharmaceutical industry, which has unlimited amounts of money and power, an industry which made $69 billion. The top 10 companies made $69 billion in profit last year, Joshua, while one out of five Americans cannot even afford the medicine that their doctors prescribe. That's how crazy it is. These guys have unlimited amounts of money. They're going to put it into lobbying. They're going to put it into campaign contributions to the insurance industry. Top five insurance companies made $20 billion in profit last year. Guy who's head of Aetna Insurance got a $500 million bonus for bringing together a merger with CVS. So I do understand that these people have enormous power. But on the other hand, what poll after poll shows, including a poll that just came out yesterday or today, that the overwhelming majority of the American people understand that healthcare is a human right, it's not a privilege, that it is insane that we have 34 million people who have no health insurance, even more who are underinsured, with high deductibles and high copayments. We pay the highest prices for prescription drugs of any country on earth, and yet at the end of all of that, we spend double what they do in other industrialized countries, and our healthcare outcomes are worse. So what you have is a dysfunctional healthcare system which cannot be defended. Its function is to make huge profits for the insurance companies and the drug companies while denying healthcare or quality healthcare to many, many millions of Americans. So I do know that the pharmaceutical industry and the insurance companies will be spending hundreds of millions of dollars in opposition to our effort to bring about Medicare for all. But I think if we can bring the American people together, and a lot of Republicans who support this, and stand up and demand that we do what every other major country on earth does, guarantee health care to all people, we will win this fight. Now, Ron asked the question, I think it was,
about the tax increase.
Good question. How you pay for it? Well, we start off by understanding and asking about how do we pay for health care right now. And as I mentioned a moment ago, right now we are spending twice as much as our neighbors in Canada and our friends in Europe are spending, and they manage to cover health care for all people. And the reason that they can do that is they do not have what we have, is a huge, complex, and wasteful bureaucracy within the healthcare system, which wastes hundreds of billions of dollars a year. According to a variety of studies, even from some conservative think tanks, Medicare for all will end up being less expensive than the current system we have right now. There are some projections right now that in a 10-year period, we will end up spending $50 trillion a year on healthcare, unsustainable. And Medicare for all will be less expensive because we eliminate the profiteering of the insurance companies and the drug companies. We lower drug prices by about 50%. And we do away with all of the administrative waste in terms of billing and the entire bureaucracy around billing and administrative costs, which are about $500 billion a year.
Now, how would that compare in terms of taxes? I mean, I hear you in terms of eliminating administrative waste, but that's, you know, it seems like we either pay it as, you know, health care, you know, as insured people just through the cost of care, or we pay it in tax dollars through the cost of beefing
up Medicare for
all. How do they compare?
Well, they would compare is that 95% of the people will, in all likelihood, under our plan, pay less for health care. We will eliminate premiums. You're not going to pay any premiums. Your employer is not going to pay premiums. We're going to eliminate deductibles and copayments. We're going to expand benefits. We are going to pay for that. And that's something that we're going to be discussing with Congress. I mean, it's a complicated issue. There are different points of view as to how you pay for it. But one of the ideas that we have brought forth is a 7% payroll tax on employers, exempting the first $2 million to protect small businesses, and a 4% tax on household income, exempting the first $29,000. So you're absolutely right. Like other countries, it will be paid for by tax dollars. Our plan calls for progressive taxation. But right now, when you have a family of four it's cost them about $28,000 a year for healthcare, and that money, that is going up. If the question is, can we save ordinary Americans significant sums of money on their health care costs while expanding the benefits that they get? The answer is yes, we can.
I know there's a lot more questions we want to get to when we come back from our break. I'm glad we had time to kind of explain this in some depth, and I want to make sure that I'm clear on what you're saying. It sounds like what you're saying is that we may end up paying more and newer taxes in some ways to build out the system, but dollar for dollar, we would overall be spending less money than we would be spending if insurance companies just got to run the table. Is that it?
That's right, because we're eliminating premiums. You're not going to pay any more health insurance premiums, nor will your employer. No deductibles and no copayments.
Okay. We've only got a little bit more time with you when we come back. There's plenty of questions we want to get to. Karen and a number of our listeners have been asking questions about women's reproductive rights and freedoms, particularly in light of the bill that just passed in Alabama, one that is believed to be on a fast track, potentially, to the U.S. Supreme Court. Also got some questions about student debt and what could be done about that. We want to make sure to ask you about foreign policy in light of everything that's been going on with Iran, North Korea, China, and Russia. And we'll get to as many more of your questions as we can when we continue with Senator Bernie Sanders, one of many Democratic candidates running for president, or candidates running for the Democratic presidential nomination. And we'll get to some more of your questions in a minute. I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Support for 1A and the following message come from the Platinum Card from American Express. Conversations and civil debate in our society push us forward and connect us with the rest of the world. With the Platinum Card, earn 5x membership rewards points on flights booked directly with airlines or with American Express Travel. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Don't live life without it. Visit americanexpress.com/exploreplatinum. Terms apply.
1965. A darkened street corner in Selma, Alabama, and a murder. A new podcast exposes the lies that kept this murder from being solved.
And explores memory, myth, and accountability for a crime at the heart of the civil rights movement. From NPR, White Lies. Listen and subscribe now.
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We are speaking with Senator Bernie Sanders, also a candidate for the Democratic presidential nomination. You have sent in plenty of great questions. I'm going to get to as many as we can before we have to shift gears, and I will take moderator's prerogative to ask the last one. But let's dive into some of your questions now. Let's see. Heather tweeted, what common sense gun laws will he support to end gun violence in America?
Okay. Well, thank you for that question, Heather, because this is an issue that is on the minds not only of so many adult Americans, but a whole lot of kids who are increasingly nervous when they walk into a school. So here's some of what you got to do, which is kind of common sense stuff. Number one, you got to have the guts to take on the NRA, and that's something I've been doing for a very, very long time. And by the way, I think the American people are catching on to what the NRA really is. Second of all, you have to expand background checks. It is not a rocket science to suggest that somebody who should not own a gun, somebody who is mentally unstable, somebody who is guilty of domestic violence or other crimes, should not own a gun. Number three, you got to get rid of the so-called gun show loopholes, which allows a whole lot of people in this country to avoid getting a background check by buying their gun at a gun show. You got to do away with the so-called straw man provision, which allows you legally to walk into a gun store today. You can legally do that and buy a dozen guns, and you can then sell those guns to people in gangs or drug dealers or whatever. We've got to eliminate that as well. And there are a number of other things that we have to do. Also, for many, many years now, for like 30 years, I have believed that assault weapons are weapons, are military weapons. They're designed to kill people as rapidly as possible. A few years ago in Las Vegas, we saw what that is about. Yeah. I do not think that those guns should be sold or distributed in the United States to the civilian population. So the other thing that we have to do is understand that you got a lot of people who are emotionally disturbed today in this country, who are walking the streets, who cannot get the help that they need. And we have to make sure that people in the United States get the mental health counseling they need when they need it, so they don't do destructive acts or self-destructive acts. So those are just some of the things that I think we should be doing.
Karen wrote on our Facebook page, would really like to hear his thoughts on women's reproductive rights, which are under attack. And another listener tweeted, considering the current assault on women's reproductive rights and freedoms, does Senator Sanders support and will he push for ratification of the Equal Rights Amendment? And of course, just by way of context, Alabama's governor signed into law the most restrictive abortion law in the nation, which could send doctors to prison for performing abortions.
Well, let me very briefly answer, Karen. Yes, I do support the Equal Rights Amendment. What's happened in Alabama is an outrage. To my mind, it is absolutely unconstitutional. You have the overwhelming majority of the American people support or at least oppose the undermining or the ending of Roe versus Wade. And yet you have in Alabama a state moving in exactly the opposite direction. One of the things that I find amazing is that my Republican colleagues here talk about a small government. They talk about getting government off of the backs of the people, limiting government's powers, deregulating everything. And yet when it comes to a very, very personal decision that a woman has to make, they suddenly think, whether it's the local, state, or federal level, they have a right to tell every woman in America what she can do or what she cannot do. And I think that that is an absolute outrage. So as somebody who has a lifetime 100% pro-choice record, somebody who is a staunch defender of Planned Parenthood, we will do everything that we can in every way, legally, politically, to make sure that these horrific pieces of legislation you're seeing in Alabama and elsewhere do not become law, that they are overturned by the courts, and that politically we move as aggressively as we can against them.
We got a few questions about a bill, now law, that you, along with all the other Democratic candidates who were in Congress at the time, voted for. It was kind of a package of bills known as SESTA and FOSTA, which were meant to tamp down on sex trafficking. There were a number of sex workers who opposed that legislation and said that it put them in danger. And we got a lot of questions about it. One tweeted, would Senator Sanders change his vote on the legislation? And another asked, what is Sanders' position on decriminalizing consensual adult sex work?
On that issue, I think, as I recall, that was a bit while ago, and it wasn't one of the major issues we were dealing with. I think that the issue was the feeling that on the internet there was an effort to make it easier for people to engage in sex trafficking. And that's something, obviously, that I strongly opposed. I think the idea of legalizing prostitution is something that should be considered. It exists in other countries, something I want to think about a little bit more, but it's certainly something that should be considered. And I think when you talk about people getting arrested prostitution, I think one should keep into consideration that the people who use prostitutes, men who visit places of prostitution or engage prostitutions, they are equally guilty. But I think the issue of legalizing it is something that certainly needs to be discussed.
Let's talk unions. One listener tweeted, can you discuss your connection with the labor movement and what policies you would pursue to strengthen unions and workers' rights in general?
At a time of massive income and wealth inequality, and this is an issue, Joshua, that we don't talk about a whole lot. I think it's profoundly important. We have three families in America owning more wealth than the bottom half of the American people. You got the top 1% owning more wealth than the bottom 92%, and you got 49% of all new income going to the top 1%. Today, the average American worker in real inflation accounted for dollars is earning about what he or she did 40 years ago. That's unbelievable when you think about all the increase in productivity and the explosion of technology. One of the reasons that we are seeing the middle class shrinking and we're seeing so many of our people working two or three jobs is the decline of the trade union movement. I have a lifetime voting record of 100%, and probably nobody in Congress supports the trade union movement more strongly than I do. I've walked on many, many picket lines in my political life. And we are going to introduce and reintroduce legislation. It's called the Workplace Democracy Act, which will be the most significant piece of labor reform in modern American history. And what it says is that 50% of workers in a shop plus one sign a card, they will be a member of a union. It also repeals the provision in the Taft-Hartley Act, which allows states to impose a so-called right-to-work legislation. It would also punish employers who refuse to negotiate a first contract with their new union. So I believe very much that the future of the middle class is dependent upon whether or not we can expand the trade union movement in this country. And I will do everything as president that I can to make sure that happens.
Senator Bernie Sanders is an independent representing Vermont, one of 23 candidates, and counting, hoping to win the Democratic nomination for president. You'll find all our conversations so far with the nominees at the1a.org/20-20. You'll find interviews with South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg, Congressman Seth Moulton of Massachusetts, and Julian Castro, the former secretary of the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. Again, that's the1a.org/20-20.
Support for 1A and the following message come from the Platinum Card from American Express. Conversations and civil debate in our society push us forward and connect us with the rest of the world. With the Platinum Card, earn 5x membership rewards points on flights booked directly with airlines or with American Express Travel. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Don't live life without it. Visit americanexpress.com/exploreplatinum. Terms apply.
A lot of people are excited that I mentioned on the air yesterday that I'll be on Fresh Air with Terry Gross on NPR.
It happened. I finally got to interview Howard Stern. There was so much to talk about, it's a two-parter. You can listen on the Fresh Air podcast.
Back now to our conversation with Senator Bernie Sanders, part of our project Foresight 2020, where we'll speak to as many of the presidential candidates as we can. Let me ask you about foreign policy for a moment, because the U.S. has withdrawn from the Iran nuclear deal. We've pulled American employees from the embassy in Iraq over threats that it said that Iran has made. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani and a number of Iranian officials have been kind of trading barbs back and forth. What is your take on the best way to go forward concerning Iran, particularly with the proxy wars that it's been fighting, its influence in the region, the nuclear concerns around Iran? What do you think is the best way forward?
Well, I think the role that Trump and John Bolton are playing is an absolute disaster. And I cannot believe, I really, literally cannot believe, that after the horror of the war in Iraq, which I vigorously opposed, and all of the destabilization that took place in the region, all the lives that were lost among the Iraqi people, among our American soldiers, I was the former chairman of the Veterans Committee, and you don't know how many of those men and women who fought in Iraq came home wounded in body or wounded in spirit. After all of that, you have a guy like John Bolton, who was one of the architects of the war in Iraq. He's back now pushing us to getting into a war in Iran, which would be even worse, much worse. And one of the issues that we have to deal with, again, not talked about too much. I talked about it a few years ago. Not too many folks were. We're talking about it now, is why the United States has as its bosom buddy, as its ally, the murderous, despotic regime in Saudi Arabia led by Mohammed bin Salman. This is a regime which is fiercely anti-democratic, treats women as third-class citizens, engaged in the murder of Khashoggi, murders their own political opponents, yet somehow or another they are a great ally and Iran is our terrible, terrible enemy. Well, I am not a great defender of the Iranian government. They have many, many serious issues as well. And you're right, supporting terrorist organizations is one. But the role of the President of the United States now must be to bring Iran together with Saudi Arabia and the other countries in the region and make it clear that we are not going to be sympathetic to any more wars in that area, that we're going to do everything we can to create a diplomatic solution. As you may know, recently I and others, Mike Lee, a Republican from Utah, and some really great people in the House in a bipartisan way, passed resolutions for the first time in 45 years since the War Powers Act was created that would get the United States out of a war that was unauthorized and, in my view, unconstitutional. That's the Saudi-led intervention in Yemen. And we passed with pretty good majorities, both in the House and the Senate. Unfortunately, Trump vetoed it. Bottom line is that a war, in my view, a war in Iran would be an unmitigated, unbelievable disaster. We are working right now to get 51 senators, a majority of the Senate, Republicans and Democrats, to tell Trump he does not have the authority. It would be unconstitutional. It is Congress that decides war and peace issues, not the president, and that he must not do this.
Last question, Senator, before we got to let you go. I hear you that the war would be a disaster in Iran. What's your red line? When would war become the right or a reasonable response?
Right now, look, anyone who knows anything about the unintended consequences of Vietnam, the unintended consequences of Iraq, would understand that we must do everything we can diplomatically before we go to war, and especially when our ally would be somebody like Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia. So the goal now is to rally the American people, make sure we have majorities in the House and the Senate to tell the president not only that he shouldn't go to war, it is unconstitutional. Constitution is pretty clear. The responsibility for war rests with the Congress, not the president of the United States. And we've got to move aggressively to make sure this disaster does not occur.
And if diplomacy fails, what then?
Well, diplomacy is not going to fail. We're going to do everything we can to prevent this war, because this war would be an unimaginable tragedy. If you thought the war in Iraq was bad, this one will be worse. So we have got to do everything we can to stop it.
Senator Bernie Sanders, an independent from Vermont, running to be the Democratic nominee for president. Senator, we always appreciate you making time for us. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Today's program was produced by Jonquilin Hill and edited by Miranda Fulmore. To learn more about JQ, Miranda, and the rest of the team, visit the1a.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.